Imagine you dedicated your career to artificial intelligence before anyone believed in it, before plentiful computing, before ChatGPT, before the breakthroughs that changed everything. Today's guest did just that, surviving the second AI winter and now helping businesses mitigate AI-related risks. My name is Alexander Nevsky, and this is Innovation Tales.
Navigating change, one story at a time, we share insights from leaders tackling the challenges of today's digital world. Welcome to Innovation Tales, the podcast exploring the human side of digital transformation.
Alec Crawford is the founder of Artificial Intelligence Risk, Inc., a company leading the charge in AI security, safety, and compliance, earning top rankings in Gen AI cybersecurity and regulatory compliance. With a Harvard background in AI and decades of experience managing investment risks at firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, he understands both the potential and the pitfalls of AI adoption. In this episode, Alec shares how enterprises can move beyond AI hype to real-world implementations. You'll learn why not every Gen AI use case is worth pursuing, how to build AI governance that actually works, and what business leaders must do now to stay ahead of emerging risks. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Alec Crawford. Alec, welcome to the show.
Alex, great to be here.
It's great to have you. You've been involved with artificial intelligence long before it was mainstream. So let's go back to where it started. I believe it was 1987 and you were writing your master thesis at Harvard. What led you to take that initial step?
Yeah, I was at Harvard. I was actually still an undergrad when I started, and I was building neural networks from scratch. And back then, if you had walked around the street and said, hey, what's a neural network? People would be like, oh, that's your brain, right? People just didn't even know what it was. Even people in computer science didn't know what it was. And it was pretty cool to be there at the beginning. And the 1980s was really a period of excitement because it was starting to work, right? You could do some natural language processing. You could teach computers to do things. I was teaching them to play poker, as an example, and bet and bluff and things that people obviously associate with humans more than computers. And my thesis advisor was a guy named Bill Woods, who had invented something called Lunar, which is a natural language processing system that let you ask questions and get answers about the rocks that have been brought back from the moon. So you could say things like, how many rocks were there? How many were igneous? What was the largest rock? It would give you answers. So back then, that was revolutionary. It was amazing. And while I was at Harvard, you know, we were still at the upslope of the hype cycle for AI back in the 80s. So people were super excited about it and just dreaming of what else you could do with it all the time.
1987 sometimes is mentioned as the point, like the beginning of the second AI winter. So from a hype cycle perspective, it was the peak. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think that people had developed some expert systems, which are supposed to mimic what experts do. And I think people were starting to see the limitations. And by early 90s, I'm not going to say AI was dead, but wow, and at least in corporate America, it was done, right? And obviously people were still doing research, and that's what eventually led to the invention of the transformer and large language models as we know them today. But yeah, there was a very dark period of time there for AI. I actually did a little bit of AI right when I came out of school at the bank I was working at. And it was more me saying, oh, they've given me a job to do. I think AI could actually do this pretty well. And I was right. But it never really took off. And it was all homegrown stuff. You couldn't go out and get a model from Google or anyone like that. It was like, if you're doing it, it's because you built it. That's it. There's nowhere else to go.
And so what was that use case for the bank?
Yeah, so there was an enormous amount of data that came in. I happened to be working in the mortgage department or the mortgage research department, and we would ingest massive amounts of information every month about mortgages, mortgage rates, and did people pay off their mortgages? Were they delinquent? Things like that. So I used the model to do some inferences around that, which was interesting and is kind of a good use case for AI, even back then, looking at lots of data and trying to train a model and see what you get out of it.
So it was predictive kind of analytics, early days.
Early days predictive analytics. And yeah, we had modest success with that. What I'd say is that kind of standard parametric models and non-parametric models ended up being longer term more successful than a neural network in that case. So some interesting things there, but in the end, just wasn't additive. And that's actually an important lesson for today. AI is so hot that people run around and go, oh, we got to use AI for X. And they use AI for X, but you may actually get a better outcome using a more traditional model or approach in some cases. And it's also highly likely in that traditional model or approach that ends up being faster and cheaper to run. That instinct to immediately go to Gen AI sometimes needs to be vetted to some degree.
Yeah, well, 1987 or a couple of years later when you were working at the bank, that's way before deep learning and neural networks had the computing power to actually be useful in the way that they are now. How did that AI winter impact you? Did you like regret studying artificial intelligence in as an undergrad?
Oh, not at all. No, it was awesome. And I loved it. And I stayed in touch with it all the time throughout my career, whether reading research or doing my own projects or occasionally adding things to work. Hey, we should try this and see if it works. And obviously it's back. But what I would say is there really wasn't much of a budget for it. You'd have to sneak it in on the side as opposed to today you've got CEOs going to heads of technology going like, do some AI thing. I don't care how much it costs, or here's $1 million, figure it out. That was not the story back then for sure.
Yeah, certainly things have changed dramatically. What's the inflection point that for you is the start of what we are experiencing today in the business world?
Yeah, I think I take it back to really the public launch of ChatGPT 2 years ago, November, which really got people's attention. So what's interesting is a lot of these, you know, techniques and models have been out there for a while. Until OpenAI put it out on the internet and said, hey, anybody can do this, a lot of people just didn't even know about it. And even in the first couple months, you had a number of people using it, but also a number of people not using it and certainly not understanding it. But it, obviously, the concept went viral pretty quickly. And the strides made even in the different model versions as we went from Llama 2 to 3 and OpenAI up to version 4.0 were tremendous. And that's something that I look at all the time, like how capable are the models and how robust are they? And can you trick them into doing things that they're not supposed to? Things like that. And just their capabilities across those different areas, both being able to answer questions, solve puzzles, but also do it in a robust manner, ethical manner, have improved. That being said, not the case for all models. So it's pretty famous that DeepSeek fails almost every one of the 350 different safety tests, right? Hey, tell me how to build a nuclear bomb. Okay, not great. But looking at that in the 80s, we weren't even dreaming of that, right? We didn't realize that someday someone would have the capacity to basically take everything from the internet and train an AI model. Like what? That wasn't even in the realm of possibility in our minds at that time.
Yeah. So when ChatGPT was announced and made available, what were you up to at that point?
I had just retired. I was from finance. I was at a company called Lord Abbett, which is a mid-size asset manager in the US. They manage mutual funds and institutional money, about $250 billion. And I was running risk and doing a bunch of other things around AI. And I played 100 rounds of golf. And actually pretty early that year, I was watching these really big companies onboard AI with just zero guardrails. And we're talking big companies. So this is crazy, right? It's not only bad for those companies if something goes wrong, but also potentially their customers, releasing customer data, their employees, putting them in bad or awkward situations or worse. Right off the bat, started writing up the first piece of code that was going to do AI governance, risk management, compliance, and cybersecurity as a platform, as opposed to single point of use or kind of just one thing. And honestly, I didn't know if it was even doable, right, to do all four things. And I had basically taught myself Python because I'm more of a C#, C++ programmer, but it was easier to template in Python, and got it running and then showed it to my co-founder, Frank Fitzgerald. He's like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I don't think I've written more than 3 lines of code since then because he took it over. So, but it was fun to go learn Python. And he's, guess what, writing it all in C# on .NET, which is obviously where you need to, what you need to do to professionalize things. So,
all right. Well, since you've broached the topic, then let's talk about that approach that you use to help clients with mitigating, I guess, the AI risk. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, it's almost impossible to get rid of all risk, no matter what you're doing. You could be standing in your house and have a fire extinguisher everywhere and not be there when it burns down, so you can't use your fire extinguisher, right? It's impossible to eliminate risk. An asteroid could strike New York City in a year and there's nothing we could do about it. Who knows? But we do mitigate risk. And I love thinking about risk the way NASA does, right? So NASA thinks about risk in a grid, right? Where it's low, medium, high impact and low, medium, high probability, and the high probability, high impact risk, well, you better be looking at, right? Maybe you don't have time to look at all 100 risks that are in your 9 boxes, but you better at least be addressing the high probability, high impact risks, you know, part of our focus. And the way I think about it is 4 pillars of risk management for AI: governance, risk management, compliance, and cybersecurity. And by governance, what I mean is the AI's got access to very specific data, very specific use cases, and then you can assign those AI agents to specific groups or people. And the flip side of that is Copilot, right? Where it gives you access to everything, and which is honestly a malicious actor's dream, right? If they capture your credentials and they get in there pretending to be you, they can ask Copilot questions like, hey, where's all the customer data? Or show me my emails from the CEO? Or do I have any access to any login credentials? And Copilot will happily answer them within seconds, and it can really compress the time on day zero that a hacker needs to do something bad, like deploy ransomware. So we do the opposite of that, very specific things. So a great example is for a call center where we constructed a knowledge bot for the call center employees. They can just type in whatever their question is and get an answer. What kinds of loans do we offer? Or what's our policy about late fees or whatever? And they can get the answer in seconds, even if they're a new employee. So that's a good example of a very specific agent. So on the risk management side, a lot of things in the world are obviously encrypted for very good reason, like our customer databases and things like that. But in AI, not necessarily, right? So graph by default are typically not encrypted. So we encrypt everything in motion and at rest, and also encrypt things on the fly. So it's, if someone happens to type a social security number into a prompt, we can set it up so either it gets blocked or it gets encrypted before it goes to the AI or leaves your firm. And think about the rules in Europe around GDPR where, wow, you better be encrypting customer data or you're going to get fined. I think Amazon had a fine that was almost €1 billion a couple of years ago for GDPR violations, but also standard stuff that we don't even think about on the internet right now, like blocking not safe for work topics or keeping people from playing games at work or whatever. That you need to do that with AI as well. And then on to regulatory compliance, right? So lots of rules around AI. What are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? Making sure AI is not doing stuff it's not supposed to. And in the US, a lot of that revolves around just keeping records of what you did with AI, especially in finance. So we have created an immutable database, keep track of every prompt, every response, every model change, and provide an e-discovery tool for regulators or compliance people to go in and see, hey, what are people doing without violating privacy rules? And then finally, cybersecurity, where we really advocate for private AI. And what I mean by that is deploying the models on your own computers, on-prem or on your private cloud. So when they're running, you don't have to worry that your secret data is leaking out somewhere. And in addition, cybersecurity beyond that is looking for different kinds of attacks on AI. So there, I'm talking about the number one risk from OWASP on Gen AI is prompt injections. And beyond that, there are things like Do Anything Now or Day and Style attacks and skeleton key attacks and multi-hot attacks. And all these things today sound like gibberish, but they will be on the front pages in the next year or two, right? As large companies get their AI hacked, ransomware, whatever, and people will learn about these things. Don't learn too late, right? You want to learn about what they are now and defend your company or yourself against them. And that's one of the things that we do.
And you mentioned at the beginning that you are approaching this from like a platform point of view. So I guess by the time that you're engaged, you're talking to them, they've already done some things and there's already a bit of a technical or security debt. Is that right?
Yeah, that can totally happen, right? The most common thing we see is companies either completely blocking all AI or allowing certain employees to use AI, but making them promise not to put anything confidential out there. So no client data, things like that. Look, human error happens every day, right? There's a story of someone I know who's works at a pretty big company, is on the AI committee, and on her phone accidentally used the regular ChatGPT instead of their walled garden version, put confidential information on there, and was suspended from the firm. This is the person on the AI committee, right? So obviously you have to take these rules seriously, but the obviously the better way to do that is simply to block all the public versions, at least on your own, on your inside your firewall or on your own intranet, and then only present the safe versions, right? The corporate versions. The good news is that we can roll out in a day our platform that includes no code agent building and this AI GRCC is what we call it, governance, risk, compliance, cybersecurity.
How long does it take to get started to deploy?
Yeah, it's super fast, right? We've got dozens of clients and deployment on Azure takes about 14 minutes. We basically use an ARM template, installs our software, sets up the compliance database, then it sets up the models, all the kind of popular large language models, base models, and a bunch of kind of standard agents, depending on what industry the client is in. And they're off to the races. One of the things I love doing is not just meeting with the person running technology or the CEO, but meeting the people who work at the company. We ask each client to come up with a focus group of people from different departments who are hopefully excited about AI. And then what are your big problems? What do we think we can solve? And things that are easy to solve and high impact, we try to do right away and get some quick wins. Things that are really hard or LLMs aren't capable of, we just tell them, hey, that's doesn't seem possible. Occasionally, clients ask for things that are either not legal or unethical very rarely. And we just remind them that, hey, that's not a great idea. Even if you could do that, you shouldn't try doing that. And sometimes it's accidental. So there's, for example, in the US, there are a lot of rules about bias in lending. So you have to be very careful if an AI agent has anything to do with lending, that it remains unbiased.
And so how do you demonstrate that the implementation that you've put in place that replaces something else is unbiased enough? How does that work?
That's a great question. We do lots of different things. We create agents for anything from call centers to loan officers to CEOs to marketing people. And 95% of the time, that there really aren't a whole lot of like legal constraints of what you're supposed to do or allowed to do. Sometimes there are, and we do deal with high-risk AI in finance and in healthcare. So a lot of it depends on the specific use case and also the guidelines, the AI guidelines set up by the company themselves and their legal or compliance team. And we can work with them to make sure that, as an example, the AI is not accessing data, which could cause it to be biased, right? Mm. We can work with them to help them understand like what data they should or should not be using when they're doing something specific, making a loan or anything like that. In the end, it's really down to the company, right? We're providing models, we're providing software, using the models and the software and the compliance system. User still has to do it correctly, right? If they aren't doing it correctly, they're not going to get the right outcome. So we automate 95% of that. It's never going to be 100% because you're always going to have AI policies, right? Which you can implement through a system. You're going to have AI procedures, things you want to do and not do, which we can facilitate. But in my opinion, everything always has to come back to a human at some point, right? To say yes or no, good idea, bad idea. Does this look right? Good example there is we have clients that use AI to fill out proposals, right? So a company you want to work for says, wow, we want to hire you. Here's our 100 questions about cybersecurity, right? And now you've got to answer those. Now, guess what? You've probably answered those 100 times already. AI can very easily go through the last 100 times you answered that and answer for the new questionnaire. But someone's got to read it, right? Because if the AI somehow gives the wrong answer or switches a word in there to claim that you're doing something that you're not, or vice versa, like that's a problem. So that's why for anything like that, you're going to want a human in the loop to make sure that everything's correct.
Having answered a number of proposals myself manually over the years, I also think that it's the same problem with humans when you have a sales team responding to a number of requests. You also have a bit of an issue where it's very hard to ensure to have every proposal go through both like the technical feasibility validation by somebody else and the legal that the from the legal department that you're not promising something that you won't be able to deliver, etc. And so you have to be pragmatic sometimes. How's that different when you're using generative AI?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because you can really do two things. One is you can use a mixture of experts, right? So you're not just answering the tech questions, you can answer the legal questions or portfolio manager questions or whatever, all from the same kind of database effectively or suite of questions you've answered before. The other thing that's interesting is you can create review agents which go through it and can flag things that look wrong or things you're not supposed to do. Like you've heard the phrase, I'm sure, in finance before, past performance is no guarantee of future results, right? So you can go through there, go through something and say, let's make sure we're not guaranteeing results, right? So you could double check things with AI as well.
That's a great point because the first thing that comes to mind, just because it's such a burdensome task, is to automate the responses, writing the answer to the questions and then having humans validate this. But what you just mentioned sounds even more appealing. Is it doesn't matter who wrote it, a human or a generative AI or a combination of both, or they were working together. Having agents that you've initialized so that they are looking for specific types of issues, that's a tool I only wish I had every time I was writing one of those responses to give myself like a bit of a safety net.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very doable now. It's obviously industry specific. Each industry has its own things they need to watch out for. But I agree. It's going to be a fabulous tool. And look, at a company I worked before, there were literally 8 people. This is their full-time job to respond to these. 1 senior person and 7 pretty junior people. And we basically had to promise them, you're only going to have to do this for 2 years. And then you get to do a real job because it was really not very fun. And the senior person's job was just making sure stuff was correct because the junior people would make mistakes sometimes. Now they're starting to use AI there, and I think it's just going to get better and better.
AI is certainly transforming business, but as Alec highlighted, success isn't just about adopting the latest tools. It's about balancing innovation with security, governance, and compliance. Not every Gen AI use case is worth pursuing, and smart companies focus on strategy, not just hype. If today's discussion got you thinking about artificial intelligence in your organization, you can check out a hands-on demo of the platform mentioned by Alec in the interview. The link is in the description. And we're not done yet. We will continue the conversation with Alec next time and explore the features and deployment of this platform, as well as broader regulatory and ethical considerations. There were too many topics to cover with Alec in one episode, so stay tuned for more tales of innovation that inspire, challenge, and transform. Until next time, peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Innovation Tales. Get inspired, connect with other practitioners, and approach the digital revolution with confidence. Visit innovation-tales.com for more episodes. See you next time.